the Buddha, to the Dharma, to the Sangha. The chapter that we've been on for some time now is called The Spirit Rises to Greet the Lord. If you read that, you'll notice, and of course I did read it, the whole of it, a couple talks ago. And one thing that you'll notice is that there's no mention in the text of the Spirit greeting the Lord, as it were. So I want to talk for a few minutes about these kind of bodily spiritual centers, you might say, that are mentioned here. I never studied the kind of yogic theory of the chakras, but I can only assume that this is that the kind of spiritual centers in the body that we speak of are probably the same thing, I guess. But since I'm no expert on them at all, and can't claim to know anything at all about them, I wouldn't want to push that too far. But I've talked a lot about the hara and the place that meditation seems to center, and where it seems that the spiritual cooking of the karma goes on in the hara. Certainly, the hara is enormously important to meditators, and you notice that in this little chapter, in the previous chapter, the tiger disappears in the hara and into a little dot, and the little Buddha is born in the hara, or manifests in the hara. Then in this chapter, the master talks about the golden Buddha moving upwards, goes up to the throat, the back of the head, then goes up to the head and sits on top of it. It moves to the front of the head, where it leaves a mark upon the forehead. I believe there's the chakras. I think there's a throat chakra, and I don't know what all these things might mean in all their ramifications, but certainly, the throat is the center of speech. That's where the vocal cords are. For if nothing else, if you wanted to think in terms of the Eightfold Path and the precepts, with regard to the throat, you can think of right speech and the precepts on that have to do with speech, not speaking against others. Not defaming others in speech, that kind of thing. The crown of the head is enormously important, and in the subsequent chapters in Lotus Blossom, in the chapters that are to come, Rim Master speaks of a number of different objects, as it were, being at the crown of the head. And it is true that, and this is where I think that the Spirit rises to greet the Lord, the title of this chapter comes from. It's at the time of Kensho, at a certain point, the crown of the head opens, as it were, and it's like it's hard to explain this, but it's like you're looking at the crown of your head towards the eternal. It's said that at the time of death, they're what's called the spirit body. At least for those who've done sufficient training, will exit via the crown of the head. Not having experienced that, I only say that I wouldn't be surprised. But I have experienced that opening of the crown of the head at the time of Kensho, and the same kind of something leaving and then re-entering. At the same time, if you'd asked me at the time, did something really leave and re-enter, I'd have to say, well, that's just not a relevant question to what's going on here. I don't have to know the answer to that to know that something's happening there and that I'm being given signals of what's happening. Signals that then I have to learn the meaning of over a period of time, a long period of time, insofar as I ever do. The forehead, the point on the forehead, called the third eye, and the forehead between the two eyes and above them, that's also enormously important. That's called the heavenly heart in some texts. It's also called the wisdom eye. And that's another place where an opening happens at a certain point or points. It's another place that one can be looking out of that place at the same time when looking with the ordinary eyes and seeing ordinary things, one somehow looking to the third eye. I wouldn't want to push any of these physical metaphors, or if that's what they are, analogies, very far, though. There's something about these openings that happen and the things that happen with them that are unique to themselves. They're uniquely spiritual. They're not, you can't kind of tie them too much to the physical or to anything else that I know of. All I can say is, well, I don't have to understand them to know that they happen. You know, we know the sun comes up in the morning, goes down at night. You know, you don't have to know what the sun is to know that the sun comes up and goes down. And I feel that way about these aspects of spiritual life. Things happen. In my own experience, it happened associated with certain choices or certain spiritual events. And here it's happening with Reverend Master associated with, you know, of course, the greatest spiritual event of her life. Do you notice in the text there's no mention of the Spirit greeting the Lord? But as I understand it, and this is again entirely from my own experience, but it's what she's talking about is when it rises and seems to leave through the crown of the head. That in my experience, whether it's kind of leaving through the crown of the head or whether you're kind of feeling like you're, you know, a completely normal, ordinary person living your normal, ordinary life, and yet there's this open, something opened at the crown of your head, and you're, as it were, something is looking out towards the eternal. Well, of course, eternal is everywhere, and yet there's something about that upwards movement and the opening there. And I had a good deal of experience of that in 1993. It seems like eons ago now, but when a part of this process happened, and now I'd like to just kind of put it in other words, because it's my actual experience of it. Like I use the term looking, and well, that again applies to a certain point, but for me, the experience has been more a worshiping, actually. And for me, it's always been associated with this upward rising of the water of the Spirit, which is the same as upward welling of love and gratitude towards the eternal. Our love and gratitude for the eternal, as it were, rising up through our body when all conditions ripen, focusing in the crown of the head, and then coming back down as the eternal's love and compassion for us. And it's all one love and compassion. You can't divide it into me and my love and the eternal's love, and yet there is that experience of love and gratitude as being one's love and gratitude for the eternal. And there is the knowing that one is loved by the eternal. If you were to divorce these events, and this is a strong caution for the whole rest of How to Grow a Lotus Blossom, the whole of the book, but especially from here on out, if you were to try to divorce these events from the context of the spiritual training, the work on oneself, the training, the precepts, the purpose of the spiritual life, the purpose of the renunciation of the world. In other words, if you divorce it from the true purpose of training, what you end up with is with a bunch of kind of magical esoterica that then people can think that they have to do kind of special practices and techniques to get to happen to them. And I just say that you cannot undergo training at a deep level for any selfish purpose. People always begin on the side of self. You have to gradually or suddenly, however it happens, leave the selfish. And of course in the Shishogi, that's why after the chapter, after the chapter on the precepts is awakening to the mind of the Bodhisattva. And what is Dogen talking about there? Charity, really generosity, especially generosity of spirit. Benevolence, tenderness, benevolence, and sympathy. What is that? A description of those four wisdoms. It's a description of unselfishness. And what is the last chapter of the Shishogi? Putting the teachings into practice and showing gratitude. Giving your life unreservedly, unconditionally into the hands of the eternal for the benefit of all beings. Not for the benefit of separate beings, for the benefit of the all beings, because all beings are of the eternal. In Christianity, they put it, do everything for the love of God. Do all your activity for the love of God. And that's the way the Christian mystics speak of it. All activity is an expression of our gratitude and love to God. And that's no different from us. We might use different words, but it's no different. And what's happening here, it simply cannot be comprehended by a selfish attitude. From a driver's seat point of view, her master's not trying to make anything happen. She doesn't care if anything happens. Things are happening as a result of the profundity of training and the accumulation of merit and God knows what else. The utter willingness, the faith and courage. And simply because it's time that it happened for her sake and for the sake of all of us who are following in her footsteps. All I can say is without this, who knows what would have become of us. This teaching, what came out of this experience, has been our spiritual rudder ever since. And it will continue to be so as long as we value it and don't don't water it down or view it as just one among the many teachings. The next chapter is called Struck by the Sword of Buddha's Wisdom. And it's just where this... This seems to come immediately after the previous one. So, everything in my body, she says, is absolutely still. Nothing stirs, within or without. I know that I have to hear something, but I do not know what. In these situations, it's like you never seem to know what to do. You never seem to know what to do. You're like flying so blind. And yet, somehow, you stumble into doing what needs to be done. Or someone is grabbed by the Eternal to help you at that key point. And I've had it happen to myself and seen it happen to others so many times. And it's a sufficient experience of this, and you begin to get the point that you actually don't need to know what's going on in order to do this. You just need a lot of faith and serious meditation. One of the monks present in deep meditation says it has something to do with the quotation, "Within these precepts dwell the Buddhas." I immediately remember that this is part of the Shushogi, but give the wrong page, thinking it is the end of the fourth chapter instead of the end of the third. Another monk, however, knows what I mean and reads the following. "Within these precepts dwell the Buddhas, enfolding all things within their unparalleled wisdom. There is no distinction between subject and object for any who dwell herein. All things," self and subject and object, I'm amused by the kind of terms that we use sometimes to translate Buddhist language. But what's subject and object? Isn't that a kind of mystifying thing? You know what it means? It means self and other. Subject is self and object is other. It's a gas, sometimes, because we can get so confused over something that's actually so obvious. Subject and object, by the way, used in this way, is a common in Western philosophy. But it just means self and other. There's no distinction between self and other for any who dwell herein. Like I was walking with Reverend Master once in the cloister, and I told this story many times. I said, "I just want to thank you for how kind you've been to me," because I was really having a struggle at the time, and she was being very kind to me. And she just said, she didn't look at me. She just walked on. She said, "How could I hurt that which is part of myself?" That's it. No distinction between subject and object. In other words, love. One knows what real love is and one isn't blocking it. All things, earth, trees, wooden posts, bricks, stones, become Buddhas once this refuge is taken. From these precepts come forth such a wind and fire that all are driven into enlightenment when the flames are fanned by the Buddha's influence. This is the merit of non-action and non-seeking, the awakening to true wisdom. Reverend Master says, "At the word awakening, something strikes me on the forehead. Where is the mark?" Remember that the Buddha left a sense of a kind of imprint on the forehead. "Something strikes me on the forehead. Where is the mark? It strikes with such force I gasp in amazement, acceptance. I cannot tell you what has happened, but one of the monks knows that for a moment I died." I have to say, I've never had this happen in this way. I've had something happen that was for me equally important with regard to that point. Reverend Master Moke again, in her diary, those of you who have read excerpts from her diary, read that she says, and I believe her, that there is a point here in her retreat where she knew that she had for a moment died. And it was a similar point of acceptance of something absolutely important. Reverend Master said, I heard her say many times about this, she said her forehead hurt for a month after that. She said, when that sword hits you, a sword of Buddha's wisdom, you'll see it, she says, you really hurt, your head really aches. This is called the wisdom eye, so it's called the third eye or the heavenly heart. My favorite word for it is a term for it. I know it's called the heavenly heart. The heavenly heart. It is true that when that opens, your whole point of view changes. It's like then you have a spiritual as well as a material or sense-based point of view. She says, my whole body is flooded with something. See, this is early days. She doesn't yet really know the water of the Spirit the way she later does. But that flooding, that great flooding she's describing, is that the big karmic block that came from that originated, or seems to have originated in that kind of despair of that tiger, is moving, you see, is dissolving. And as it, and the water of the Spirit is flooding through her whole being, washing away the bits and pieces that are still floating in the circulating stream. And so this is a common experience of people at this time, is this great flood of the water of the Spirit. I've described it as when it flows fully, it is so powerful, you know that it could take your life. I suppose at times it actually does take someone's life when it's right to do so. But the thing about the water of the Spirit is that it's entirely good and benevolent and will never do harm. So if it did take your life at that point, it's because it was time for you to go. In its most powerful physical sense, it feels like this unimaginable, powerful electricity. Not painful, but unbelievably powerful. A great flood of it like this can leave a person so weak that they literally cannot move or barely move for a while. I've described it as being plugged into thousands of volts of electricity. And everything in you just kind of gets blasted open. You're kind of liquefied, as it were. And everything goes incredibly bright. Everything just goes incredibly bright with this. You'll see. I'll just read on here. This is just what happens. It doesn't happen to everyone in exactly the same way, but the general things being described happens. She says, my whole body is flooded with something. My hands are open in a gesture of wonder and amazement. I don't know if wonder is the right word, just amazement and acceptance. Might also just be joy. That's another word. But it's a joy that is so transcendent of what we normally think of as joy, is it can be a little hard to recognize it as such. She says, my head pains considerably from the blow, for indeed it is a blow from the sword of Buddha's wisdom. With it, something opens in the center of my forehead where the mark is, and into it streams yellow light, golden light. The water of the Spirit can be experienced as liquid or electric or as light. It's all the same. That's the thing. Or love. Gratitude. You know, you can't pin it down. You can't pin it down. It's not, if you say it to any one of them, you're wrong. Because it's infinite in its aspects, infinite in its goodness. Infinite in its benevolence. She says, for a long time I lay very still, and then it is over. I am conscious of the fact that there seems to be something upon my head, and I know that it is like a lotus blossom crown. I know, too, that there is something above my head. The same monk says that he sees what seems to be a bud on a silver stem. At the time of it being struck, I asked the others what they saw. I don't know how many people are with her there, but there's a few monks meditating with her there. It was an amazing thing that she shared this with her disciples this way, you know. It's wonderful. She says, one saw a great silver sea, and within it a bright light that he knew was my body. A third saw a great silver and green lotus floating above high mountains. See, everyone's going to experience it in their different way. It's the meaning is the same. The meaning is the same. Enlightenment is happening. Get it? Flag waving. Enlightenment happening. Disciples, look at this. Look at what she's done for the last few months. This is the way to go. You see? Hey, you disciples, this is the way to go. It's never just given for oneself alone. It's for all of us. It's for all beings. Then she describes some more things that monks say. I won't go into that because they're all, you know, individuals' expressions of or experiencing of the same basic thing, but of course they're experiencing empathically, whereas Reverend Master is actually the one who's going through it. She says, I am conscious of the bud on my head and can see the crown when I look upwards. It is as though I can see the top of my head and that which is on my forehead. I almost never look down, always up. That's for sure. I'll just talk now a little about my own experience in 93, just for a moment. When I was experiencing that, looking up through the crown of my head, it was like I was looking at, I must have got the karma of a monk who was a Pure Land monk, or who was deeply devoted to Avalokiteshvara and Amitabha. You know, Avalokiteshvara is one of the bodhisattvas attendant on Amitabha, or Amida Buddha. Is that right? I believe that's right. Well, if it ain't right, it's right for me anyway. Let's put it that way. And in 1993, I was having these kind of visions, this kind of sense of Amida up there. I was kind of looking at the crown head of Amida and at Kanzion. You know, I knew at the time aspects of the eternal with this upwelling of quiet love and gratitude. It's this adoration and worship. I even wrote some hymns at the time. I wrote a couple of hymns, Amida, or one or two, and a couple of Avalokiteshvara, one or two of them. I was just in retreat at the time for, I don't know, a couple months maybe. And that turned out to be kind of some of my retreat work was to write some hymns. And I knew at the time that it was more than any Buddha or Bodhisattva. It's always more. It's never less than. It's always more than. And yet these were being used. These were the way in which the eternal showed itself to me at that time. at other times in other ways. And so I'll just close this talk with something that I think is really helpful from the Rinpoche Master used to say about what happens at the time of death. You know, at the time of death, shortly after your death, somewhere in there, doesn't take too long. I think it's pretty immediate, actually. Some aspect of the eternal that has a particular meaning for you manifests to greet you, welcome you. I think to help you not have fear, and help you basically relax and go with the flow this time when often people are afraid. And this, for Christians, when they die, it's often like Jesus or Mary shows up. For some people, it might be their master. If there's a Buddhist, it might be your master shows up. When I was sitting in meditation with Reverend Master's body after she died, you know, we all got a chance to sit with her in the Founder's Shrine. Usually just, one or two or three of us at a time sitting in there with her. You know, at that time, I just had this assurance from somewhere. I just had this assurance that when I die, Reverend Master will be there. Her mess will be there to greet me. I'll see her face to face again when I die. Well, I'm not thinking that's the Ribbon Master, exactly the Ribbon Master that I knew in lifetime, because that Ribbon Master died. And yet, I'm thinking it's exactly what Ribbon Master was in lifetime, because that's what Ribbon Master truly is. Ribbon Master always was that. An aspect of the eternal given to me, her disciple, and to others as well, but I'll leave others out of it because, you know, I'm not them, I'm me. Given to me, her disciple, to show me the way to the eternal in this lifetime. And I figure, well, when I die, I'm kind of literal-minded on this kind of thing. I think she's going to be there and she showed me the way in lifetime. I think she's going to show me the way when I die, too. And I'll leave it for other people to worry about who it is that actually shows up. But, you know, I'm not going to quibble. It can be Avli Keteshvara, it can be Amida, it can be Rim Master, it can be the man in the moon. I know something. So I know something of what that love is. I know that it always is there to help us in our time of need and to show us the way if we just look for it. And what has happened, Ramesh used to say also, the best preparation for death is just to have kenshos in life. Because when you have kensho, you experience what you'll experience in death. Some things may be in a different order. The essential thing, the complete letting go and being completely, well, the complete surrender to and being one with the eternal and the love of the eternal, at least for a moment. Well, that's common to kensho, it's common to death. Person could, you know, the Buddha talked about death this way, and a bunch of people went out and killed themselves. You ever heard that story? I've never read the story, but I've been told it by a number of people that the Buddha talked about death in this way, and some people actually went out and killed themselves thinking, well, why wait? You know, let's get on with the good stuff. But of course, it doesn't work that way. Remember when I just said, at least for a moment, you know, if you got a bunch of uncleaned up karma and you're being willful, of course, it will just be a moment. Because karmic consequence is inexorable, and that which needs to manifest as pure karmic consequence will do so when all conditions ripen. So you can't cheat in that way. There's no cheating allowed. There's no shortcuts. So, you know, if you ask me, well, Koshin, you think that about death, you know, are you afraid of death? And I'd say, well, every sane person is afraid of dying. That's one thing that helps you not do stupid things to get yourself dead. But whether I will be afraid at the actual time I die, I don't know. Knowing me, since I'm afraid of just about everything else, I'll probably be afraid then too. But knowing the eternal will help me then as the eternal's helped me all the other times I've been afraid. You could also say, well, Koshin, if you think that's, you know, that's the way death is, you know, don't you long to die? And I say, after my first Kensho, there was a couple days when I did long to die. Because I really knew. I knew in my blood and bones that death could be for anyone who truly trained and cleaned up the karma. It could be what's called parinirvana. Full, final reunion, recognized reunion with the eternal, as the master put it. Well, that's well and good, but, you know, that wore off in about, you know, 36 to 48 hours and left me with my normal thing about death, which is I ain't anxious for it at all. I'm not rushing towards it. Looking forward to it. I love life very much. And it's time to go. Might as well go with the flow. Don't you know? To the Buddha, to the Dharma, homage to the Sangha.